traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. This podcast episode may have ads and the occasional announcement. To listen without ads or announcements and take advantage of a host of other benefits, consider becoming a premium subscriber. Visit the website contrarian.supercast.tech. That's T-E-C-H for more information. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
Doug Grenick, thank you for joining the Contrarian Investor Podcast today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. I'm really looking forward to this conversation because you told me right before you are not a contrarian, but then you call yourself Mr. Dislocation, which sounds contrarian. But actually, what I want to do is start off big picture, very big picture. After what happened this weekend, we record this on Monday, April 15th, 2024. And this weekend, obviously, we had that scare issue with the Iranian drone attacks against Israel, which briefly caused whatever markets were trading, which weren't much, to go haywire. Now, the reason I raise this is not because we're going to talk about the Middle East, but because we are going to talk about, however briefly, geopolitics and the big picture there, because this, of course, informs one's trading and investment philosophy. And you have something that's actually pretty contrarian there. So over to you and tell me about it and your view here on the world.
Well, the world is changing a lot. The world of my childhood was one where the United States dominated everyone militarily, culturally, politically, economically. There was a unipol. And for a while, the Soviets and the communist system competed, at least militarily. But that passed in the 1990s. And it was a very unusual state of affairs that emerged. In human history, there really has never been a single dominant world power with the sort of authority and power across many dimensions that the United States had in the 1990s and the early 2000s. You know, Rome never conquered Persia, essentially its next door neighbor. There have always been multiple powers competing on the global stage, rubbing up against each other. But for a brief moment, Francis Fukuyama immortalized in his book, The End of History, the United States towered over everyone. That's changing. Everybody already knows that China actually has a larger economy once you adjust for purchasing power. But the thing that's also changing is on the military side. Technology is kind of leveling the playing field in ways that are very complicated and very interesting. You know, in the Iraq wars, the Gulf War, the United States was able to mass a huge number of troops near the Iraqi border and move in. These days, with the advent of missile technology and drone technology, massing troops is no longer, according to most military analysts, a viable option in many situations. And it is precisely this change of military technology that is allowing the sandal-clad Ansarullah, the Houthi rebels or government, as it were, of Yemen to frustrate Operation Prosperity Guardian, okay, in the Red Sea. So the world is becoming a much more complicated place, and it's one in which the U.S. is going to find it significantly harder to achieve the political outcomes it wants in far-flung parts of the world. And that has implications. There's implications for defense spending. It has implication for commodities, for supply chains, for many different things. It's not going to be a unified world order in the way that we had seen or have seen prior decades.
Interesting. Not to get too much into this political, geopolitical discussion, but just a couple points here I do want to raise. First of all, China, and we're still talking about a country that doesn't have much of a navy, and that for all intents and purposes could be cut off of oil imports from the Middle East if the U.S. Navy really wanted to do it. And so there's that. But you're saying that China is also, we've seen, talking about purchasing power, I mean, the yuan, their currency is a bit of a mess. Anybody you talk to from China wants to get their assets into something dollar denominated, or at least not yuan denominated, RMB denominated. So is it really fair to say that China is going to rival the U.S., or already is rivaling the U.S.?
Oh, absolutely. Look, China's having a bad moment.
Yeah.
Okay. Because they're having a property crisis. Okay. And there's no denying that China has a bunch of issues. But hey, let's go into the bathroom and take a look in the mirror. So are we. Okay. We have a lot of problems. So do they. But the reality, my CTO just came back from a trip to China visiting relatives. His wife is Chinese. And he said it is mind-blowing, the rate of change and the rate of progress. Now, with respect to China, no, they're less able to project power by far than the U.S., but they absolutely dominate several hundred miles of their coastline with the People's Liberation Army rocket force. And so they put their money into hypersonic missiles, where they're the world leader, and other technologies that will allow them to essentially fight a very good defensive battle and dominate within several hundred miles. The broader point is the Chinese do not necessarily have the same ambitions that we do. They want to be a very big player in their neighborhood. But to my knowledge, and your listeners can correct me if I'm confused on this point, they have one military base that's widely known in Djibouti. And I think they have 200 Marines there playing mahjong. Okay. We have something like 900 military bases, sort of stretching our budget to the breaking point. $1 trillion a year spent on defense plus intelligence. The Chinese are spending a lot less. And different goals. The United States wants to be able to project power and basically be the global policeman. And by the way, I don't think the U.S. has necessarily done a terrible job of it. You know, who would you nominate? Okay, if you wanted somebody else. So I'm not trying to bash the U.S., although we've definitely done some stuff that everyone agrees was wrongheaded, mistaken, and in some cases not particularly well-intentioned. Okay, but it's not clear that the Chinese even want this role. They just want, they want a lot of economic development. They'd like to reunify, what they regard to be Chinese territory, such as Taiwan. And, it's not clear to me that they're thinking on the same terms that we are. But think of this. They're graduating more material scientists per year by a factor of 10 or 20 than we are. Their educational system in the technical subjects is absolutely top notch. The guy to listen to on this, by the way, is David Goldman. He very much has a sensible and deep take on China. It makes us uncomfortable. It makes us uncomfortable. But by the way, it's okay. Maybe we should be graduating more material scientists, physics students, maybe we should be making some more high-speed train. Last I heard, we weren't making much progress there in California over the last 30 years. You know, and maybe we should repair that bridge in Baltimore on a shorter time frame than the next 10 years.
That'll be nice, yes. Do you think that there is anything that can replace the U.S. dollar hegemony?
Right now, no. Hmm. What I'm describing is the classic gray rhino risk. You see, you got Nassim Taleb with his black swans. But there's a whole menagerie of risks, I understand. I'm trying to better acquaint myself with this menagerie. I like animals a lot. Mm-hmm. There's the gray rhino, and that is the huge thing. You know it's there. You know it matters a lot. But it's moving kind of so slowly at the moment that you can't quite get everybody together, right, to do something about it. Because it's not today. It's in a sense, the human nervous system is miscalibrated for risks like that. We're pretty good if a wild boar jumps out, okay, and charges at us. You know, we know to quickly run to a tree. If something is moving slowly enough toward us, whether it is, climate change potentially, or the U.S. budget crisis, we're always postponing it until tomorrow, doing something about it. We can't agree among ourselves. I think we need a little more adrenaline, right? And so the U.S. dollar it'll probably be the case that in some future decades, something will replace it. I don't see that happening in the short run.
Do you see any other countries? We mentioned China. Are there any other countries that are particularly interesting, even from an investment standpoint, that could compete, I guess, with the U.S., with China, on the global stage?
Well, the U.S. has some of the best companies in the world.
Yeah.
So I'm not arguing, one of my friends in China is a prominent public intellectual there. And, you know, I was expressing my frustration with how the U.S. government works and the choices we have. It's the same thing all Americans complain about often. And he said, you're right. You are pretty bad. He said, but you have the best companies in the world. So the U.S. has a lot going for it. But what I'm saying is the U.S. is not going to play the same role on the global stage of calling the shots in every corner of the globe. It's just not.
Yeah.
Because it can't. Okay. It's too expensive. We're out of money. And other people also kind of want to govern themselves, and do their own thing. One interesting part of the world is where I'm speaking to you from. I live for most of the year in Abu Dhabi, in the United Arab Emirates. And here we have one of the most interesting, fast-growing economies with one of the best governments you could possibly imagine. Here, the planning is done on a 10, 20, 30-year basis. And you just wouldn't believe the quality of public services, the quality of life, the complete absence of crime. It's like no one's ever heard of a crime. I haven't locked my door in 3 years, okay? And it's an amazing, amazing place to live. So I feel very privileged to be here. But it's an interesting contrast. What I'd encourage your listeners to do is to travel a lot. Spend some time in different places and, you know, get the vibe, see the energy. And, you know, it's really mind expanding, whether you're spending time in Qatar or Beijing or Portugal or the UK. So the Middle East is happening in many respects, even while there are some tensions and problems.
Of course. But the Middle East, I mean, Emirates being one example, I mean, this is all built on oil wealth, isn't it? I mean, I know these economies have tried to diversify away, but the bottom line is, you know, their main product is oil or I guess gas in Qatar's case, but it's commodities based and they're commodities exporters and that's what their economy relies on, does it not?
To a large extent, yes, but there'll be a couple points I make. First off, if you I don't know if you guys have read Václav Smil's book, How the World Really Works. It's an amazing, amazing, interesting book. But the top experts who are not being political, they recognize that our dependence on fossil fuels is going to continue far into the future globally. Far. Okay? There's no easier quick replacement. Now, that doesn't make me happy because I'm not one of the climate change, you know, denialists or whatever terms you want to use. Things are happening with the climate. Okay? My cousin is a climate scientist at MIT, and he has no big political agenda. And, you know, he thinks the case is quite strong. So the oil business, the fossil fuel business is here to stay for a long time. The correct approach to energy security is all of the above. We should be doing sustainables, renewables, nuclear in size, and fossil fuels. And if you do all of that, you might just have enough energy to power this increasingly populous, you know, world where the energy demand is going up. The amount of energy used per capita is an excellent mark of development in general. Excellent mark of development. That's a key point in Smeal's book. So, yes, the economies here continue to be very significantly fossil fuel based, but they're making huge investments in developing other things. For example, we have a university here. It's the MBZ, University of Artificial Intelligence, and their faculty is one of the best in the entire world. They essentially imported a large part of the faculty of Carnegie Mellon in the US. And they're fantastic people. And I'm working on a project with them. It's very interesting and exciting. So the point is, a lot of these Middle Eastern states that are wealthy, they have the money to invest in green tech and new initiatives. In the West, we have, in England, for example, I'm a British citizen, as well as American. We have the desire and the will and the green spirit. It's not clear that we have the money to undertake the kinds of things that we can undertake here in Abu Dhabi or in Saudi or Qatar.
Sick of me yet? Become a premium subscriber and avoid all ads or interruptions. Other benefits as well. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech. for more information.
Okay, so how does this all translate into investment strategies, I guess? You have a trend following model, which is sounds more short-term based, right? But how does this kind of all work together?
We trend follow over the medium term, capturing trends that can last months and even close to years. You know, it depends on the behavior of the trend. So what we do is we trade 500 assets ranging from French electricity to California carbon emissions to steel rebar onshore in China, methanol, Chinese glass, credit default swaps in Europe, freight from the Middle East to the China Gulf, Panamax, Cape Max, all sorts of stuff. So we trade a vast array of assets covering all major liquid sectors. And we're looking for motion and movement. And so a world that's characterized by change and by things being different is a world where you're going to have trends.
Right.
And essentially the way you trade trend, just to give you, make it as simple as possible, but this is the ultimate truth, is you go with the movement, and then using your models, you detect when the volatility starts to increase, because changes in narrative correspond usually to changes in trend and to increases in volatility. So around those corners where trends are changing, you get a jump in vol, and having sophisticated systems that can detect that, okay, allows you to get out
yeah,
and get smaller so that you don't get hurt when it moves the other way.
Really interesting. Yeah. You're our second straight trend following guest that we had on. The Trend Is Your Friend was the title of our last podcast episode. But this begs the question, where are you seeing some trends that are due for reversal? or are there any trends that are dominant right now?
Well, right now one trend that has been going on for a while is for lower electricity costs in Europe. Essentially, what's been happening in the European power markets is they shot up and went crazy after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and that conflict got underway. And later the Nord Stream pipeline was blown up. Okay. And there was considerable concern about how the Europeans would get through the winter with their rather depleted supply of natural gas. The main fuel in Europe is natural gas, okay? Especially since the Germans stopped using nuclear. France has a large nuclear fleet, however. But what happened was that LNG came online very, very quickly, being shipped from the US and elsewhere. And right now, gas stockpiles are quite high in Europe. And so there's been a trend lower. However, my personal instinct is that's a trend that's liable to reverse, okay? We're really at pre-war levels. Hmm. One thing that has been driving it is another important trend, the deindustrialization of Germany. Mm-hmm. I don't know how this happened to Germany, but it's been a perfect storm. A combination of that energy shock a few years ago, regulation, environmental policies, and China's weakness. Because as we were discussing earlier, China is going through a bad patch, no question, right? And so China was such an important export market for Germany. Mm-hmm. The German data are terrible, okay? Germany's clearly in recession. And you probably saw ThyssenKrupp is cutting back on steel production. I think that came out last week. So there's a lot of interesting stuff happening, but that is weighing also in the short run on energy prices in Europe. Hmm. But I see that reversing eventually. They just don't have such a great energy situation. And that's where geopolitics also comes in.
But it sounds like the move from importing Russian gas or whatever, to US or other sources was pretty seamless.
It worked far better than most of us expected.
Yeah.
I think it was probably helped by the fact that industrial demand was weak. If the economy had been growing more strongly, perhaps it would have been more problematic.
Mm-hmm. Can Germany shift to services? Haven't they been shifting? They have been shifting to services like the U.S. has. I mean, we were once upon a time an industrial powerhouse, and then we outsourced it all, and now we're bringing some of it back. But can Germany do the same thing? And haven't they been? And won't that be ultimately?
They're gradually shifting, but all this stuff takes a lot of time. You got to remember that so many of their services are not consumer services. Their services to support their industrial exporting engine, let's say commercial legal services. And I mean, Germany was basically, somebody used to joke that Germany was an Asian country stuck in Europe, a massive exporter, tremendously, tremendously good at engineering and so forth. And, Germany, of course, has benefited tremendously by being part of the euro and getting a cheaper currency. It's been a less good deal for the people at the periphery.
Interesting. So that's a potential issue there for, German stocks.
So that's another interesting place to look. And the big question, of course, is the U.S.
Yeah.
We've had one heck of a rally in financial assets in the U.S. Okay. And some of it has been driven by the tremendous resilience of the U.S. economy. Most smart macro people got the U.S. economy wrong. Mm-hmm. I'm telling you that because I know them, okay? And we mostly got it wrong.
They've been on this show. Yeah.
Based on history, right, the amount of monetary tightening that we saw, whether you look at it in terms of money supply aggregates or you look at it in terms of changes in real interest rate, it was pretty extreme. And the economy just kept sailing. And I think I understand the reason. But I wish I had understood it more clearly at the time. In retrospect, I think I did. The basic issue is older affluent households have become an increasingly important share compared with when I was a kid. They're really important. It's older and affluent, and they have so much money. It's just ridiculous. When you get into the older affluent crowd, the median household net worth is, you know, headed toward $500,000. But then when you go to younger, okay, and less affluent, it's low. The haves are all gray-haired people riding around in pastel clothes and golf carts, planning their next vacation. I mean, I exaggerate a little bit for the purpose of being humorous and making my point, but it's a strange state of affairs, and they're not interest rate sensitive. In fact, for some of them, increasing interest rates helps them because they have some savings. So this has kept the consumption end of the economy ticking along. And then, of course, we have the best economy that an 8% or 7.5% of GDP deficit will buy. That sure helps. And so those two factors, older, affluent. By the way, you can look at it through excess savings. During the pandemic, the money supply expansion produced tremendous excess savings. Where did it go? Went to older affluent people, okay? And the less affluent crowd burned through what they got in a hurry.
Yeah.
Statistics. And then you have the huge expansion. Can you believe that we're running the deficits that we are when we have such low unemployment and decent GDP growth?
Yeah. I mean, right. You kind of can't put that back in the bottle, can you? It's interesting. There used to be at least one major political party that was for fiscal constraint and fiscal conservatism. And that there's very few politicians in the U.S. that are even giving that lip service anymore. It's all about expanding, you know, going debting and taking on new debts to finance whatever, including servicing the old debts. But this idea that we should balance the budget seems like it went out with the older Bush, right?
You know, I have an Argentine acquaintance, and I was complaining about the short-termist. And when I use the term populist, I don't mean it as some swipe at Republican populists. But by populist, I mean saying and doing whatever you need to do to get votes and win an election, kind of. Whether that is canceling a bunch of debt for the public or some tax cut you can't afford or whatever. You know, I was saying that populism, you know, it's just, and she said, populism, in my view, as an Argentine, it's the end point of democracy. That's what democracy is. That if you can persuade the public and give them some dopamine hits and some goodies right now, they'll take it. And there won't be a great deal of concern about the consequences down the line. I hope she's wrong. But what I've seen over the course of my life in American politics is a steady trend toward not being able to take tough medicine and just kind of kicking the can down the road. And so in that context, I kind of worry a little bit about risk assets in the stock market. I was saying the stock market is high because of, first, the resilience of the U.S. economy, and we've given two reasons for that resilience. And it'll probably stay resilient. And then the second thing, the next thing is, of course, the AI revolution. And I don't know how much time you've spent with ChatGPT and other AI. I'm pretty amazed, okay? And I'm decently difficult to amaze. So it's impressive and getting more impressive by the day. So I think that enthusiasm is pretty legitimate.
Okay, right. But it does sound like, where else have you seen any trends? I mean, a lot of these things are that you follow, that you mentioned earlier, are big trading and consumption patterns globally. And what else are you seeing there?
Well, as you mentioned, we're seeing a fair bit of weakness and difficulty in China because there's very low consumer confidence and people are saving more. The good news for China is they have so much savings that when the Chinese consumer gets more confident, they can buy everything in the world. China has a savings rate and an investment rate as well that is just astronomical, 30 to 40%, depending on how you want to measure it. Very, very high. But right now, the Chinese consumer is hunkering down to some degree, and that's proving a problem. So that's one big trend. Another very important trend is because of concerns about the U.S.-China competition, more and more Western companies are kind of pulling out and focusing on India, Mexico. They sometimes call this nearshoring. And that is a trend that's helping India. India is doing very, very well for a variety of reasons. It's still very far behind China, but it's doing quite well. That's a very, very important trend. We're seeing a very strong trend in various commodities that are needed for the energy transition. One guy to listen to on that subject is Robert Friedland of Ivanhoe Mining. He's a very articulate commentator and expert on this, and billionaire too. So he's very good. But the point is this, we're moving ahead with the global economy so quickly, but digital change is happening so quickly. Do you know how many years it takes to open a big copper mine? It's like the molecular economy moves at a different speed from the digital economy. And so we're going to be hitting bottlenecks on the materials needed for battery production, okay, and for a build out of infrastructure, for example, the electrical grid. You need a lot of copper and other metals for that. So we're seeing some significant trends beginning to develop there. Copper has been very strong lately.
So you got copper, you got industrial metals, cobalt, lithium. Yes. Those are things that are often mentioned with,
But in a certain sense, these are gray rhino things that that in the long run, they're going to be moving.
Yeah.
But it may not be today.
Yeah.
It may not.
Is there any concern you think that this electrical vehicle revolution, I mean, Tesla, as we just saw today, cutting jobs. And there's some whispers that, these electric vehicles aren't that great because they don't have the range and blah, blah, blah. And they're so much more expensive, et cetera. Is there some concern that that whole trend, the consumer trend of moving towards electric vehicles, is going to reverse?
I don't want to get too far out of my lane where I don't feel that I have expertise, but I'll make a few comments. Hybrids, it would be more a battle between hybrids and That's electric. Right. Okay. And there's a great case for hybrids. But some of the same issues on batteries and metals and materials that you need are present in both.
Yeah.
I think one of the biggest challenges is the scale of investment that is taking place in China. It always amuses me. We seem to cycle between extreme enthusiasm and mania about China. That would be a few years ago.
Yeah.
Okay. Paranoia. Oh my God, they're going to take over the world. And then depression and gloominess, they're falling apart. And we actually managed to cycle through these attitudes sometimes multiple times per day. And we should we should just calm down, have some chamomile tea or take some CBD and just chill a little bit because kind of it's not that unstable. So Janet Yellen just visited. Okay. And the visit didn't go to China and visit didn't go that well, according to the reports I read. And she's kind of begging them not to flood the market with cheap, good electric vehicles, solar panels, and other products. And I don't know. I would, first off, I'd think from a green standpoint, that would be a pretty good thing for the world. If you can get a nice electric car for 12 grand or something. Mm. But the issue is, if China's saving 40% or 30 some percent and investing a similar proportion of GDP, okay, in productive activities, and some of them aren't productive. You can build too many apartment buildings, but some of them are productive. They're going to get awfully good, awfully fast, and have huge economies of scale in these things. And the answer is for us to invest more, not to send Janet Yellen over there. You know, it's just pitiful. And, you know, we should up our game. That's my opinion right now.
Yeah, well, I mean, here too is one of the problems of democracy, right? Is you need a consensus of some kind to move forward, right, with these big infrastructure spending and other projects. And sometimes, especially now, you just aren't going to get it, right? Whereas in China, they decide to build a highway. They start building the highway the next day, right, if the CCP decides that's what it wants.
Yes, that can be good or bad depending on the decisions. I mean, you can, you know, sometimes student body left, student body right is a disaster.
Exactly.
But, you know, but sometimes it isn't. I mean, I think that probably it would work better if we had a slower representative form of government where we choose some wise people to govern us at regular intervals and they spend time governing, not campaigning.
Yeah,
and then kind of trust them a little bit to take decisions as opposed to going from one focus group to the next and bouncing from one crisis to the next.
You have to wonder if, like, the whole Highway Act, I've spent a lot of time these last months driving on highways in the U.S., and you have to wonder if the whole, you know, the interstate highway that Eisenhower kind of put to work there, if you could come up with that today if you needed to.
You couldn't.
And
we have to ask what changed. And ironically, and again, I'm just an observation. I don't know what to think. It's all pretty confusing for me. And I don't like having these realizations in my, you know, as I get older, I'd rather have a nice stable view emerge. But participatory democracy has increased steadily. Do you realize that Hubert Humphrey, I'm told, and again, please correct me if you think I'm wrong, he was the Democratic nominee in, I think, 68. And he was a pretty fabulous guy, according to my dad, whose opinion I trusted. And Hubert Humphrey was chosen at this convention. It was kind of a mess. He had not won a single Democratic primary. Politics was still an insider's game. Now, it had good features and bad features, okay? But it's not clear that a Hubert Humphrey could even emerge on the stage now. Mm-hmm. In the 1970s, we changed the primary process, the nomination process, to make it more participatory, if you will. And we ended up getting kind of outsider candidates like Jimmy Carter, as an example, or later Donald Trump. Donald Trump, I'm making no attack at him, but he would never have come to the fore in the Democratic Party of the Republican Party of the Eisenhower administration. And I don't know if it's good or bad to be this responsive. You can have a car where the steering is too twitchy. You know, not sure.
Yeah. Well, these are things to think about. All right, Doug Greenick of Florin Capital, I want to take a quick break and then I want to come back and I want to ask you some more questions about your firm, about your trading, about your history as an investor, as we tend to do at the start of the second half of the program. But I want to first take a quick break and come back. If you are a premium subscriber, you will not get the break. Do not touch the dial. We will be right back. In fact, we already are. And everybody else, to become a premium subscriber, visit the website contrarianpod.substack.com and sign up.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of the Contrarian Investor Podcast, where we give voice to those who challenge a prevailing narrative in global financial markets. Consider becoming a premium subscriber. For $9 a month or less, premium subscribers receive a number of benefits. Podcasts are posted immediately after they're recorded. Transcripts are made available within 24 hours. Premium subscribers get direct access to the host. And of course, there are no ads or interruptions. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information.
By the way, you don't need the .tech suffix to get to that website. .com will do the trick. And we also have a Substack that you can, where you can sign up for the same prices, same benefits, same details, contrarianpod.substack.com. So if you already have a Substack account and use it, or have the app and use that, that's probably the best way to go. So contrarian.supercast.com or contrarianpod.substack.com, whole bunch of benefits, including, of course, getting this episode up to a week early without ads or annoying announcements. And you also get the Daily Contrarian briefing and podcast that is released every market day morning at 7 a.m. This is a contrarian take on the events of the day ahead and what is likely to move markets, such as economic data releases, earnings, and other things. It is really good, and that is completely unbiased, of course. So check that out, contrarianpod.substack.com or contrarian.supercast.tech. Now on with the show.
Welcome back, everybody. Doug Greenick of Florin Capital joining us from Abu Dhabi there in the United Arab Emirates. Doug, this is the section of the show where we ask our guests to tell us a little bit more about him or herself and how he or she arrived at this station in his or her life. And curious how you ended up there in Abu Dhabi, but maybe you could take us back into your origin story as an investor, how the whole thing got started and how your career unfolded to this point.
Well, like most people's lives, it was a series of accidents and choices kind of interspersed. And so I studied economics at Princeton. And when I got done with my studies there, I went on and got a PhD in mathematics from Berkeley. While I was getting my PhD, I worked at Barra in Berkeley, California, with some of the big names in the equity quant space. After I finished, Fisher Black hired me, and I worked for him and for Bob Litterman at Goldman Sachs, where I went on to the bond arbitrage desk in New York. After a period, I was actually running the New York bond arbitrage desk at Goldman, and we were using things like term structure models and to trade fixed income and macro. Following Goldman Sachs, I joined Greenwich Capital, which was a very, very good fixed income shop based in Greenwich, Connecticut. And I ran the bond arbitrage desk there, one of two bond arbitrage desks, and the eventually went on to run the customer business and mortgages. And so I did that for a number of years. So that business there is, again, very much fixed income and macro oriented. You're thinking a lot about what the Fed is doing, what's happening in the world, and so on. And so following that, I went on to Fortress Investments, where I did quant macro work, and then to AHL, where I became the head of risk and the head of a team called the Portfolio Management Group. And then I founded my own firm, Florin Court Capital. And that, I guess I founded that in 2015. And we've been trading the Florin Court Capital program since 2017. We have some of the best performance results of anybody in our space because of the diversification that we achieve through trading these 500 alternative and exotic markets that most people don't trade. It's a difficult operational lift to be trading Turkish interest rates, wet freight, from the Middle East to the China Gulf and California carbon emissions. But we have the operational capability to do that. We have two offices of about equal size. Our head office is in London, but two of the three partners spend most of the year at our Abu Dhabi office, where we have a similar number of people. Most of the people on the team have PhDs in, statistics or mathematics or computer science. As I said, mine was mathematics from Berkeley.
Very cool. Wow. A question about all these esoteric, these exotic, securities. We had somebody on a little while ago who was talking about rare earths. And those are something that apparently you can't really trade. How do you trade all these things? I mean, it can't just be all in one exchange, can it?
Oh, well, there are some things you just can't trade. Okay. Yeah. Or you trade them through ETFs or something.
Okay.
Very specialized things. But in other cases, let's say you're talking about freight. You become a member of the Baltic Exchange.
Yeah.
Which requires you're being nominated by people and so on and so forth. And then you have to get the data and build the models. Because we have such expertise over so many years in trading exotic markets, dealers will come to us. And that's because we're pretty nimble. We're specialists in this. And so they'll come to us and say, Doug or Dave or Tony, my two partners are Dave Dennison and Anthony Vinitsky. They'll come to us and say, we've got a market that you ought to be interested in. Have you ever thought about trading saffron? And I'd say, well, no, I haven't. Tell me more. And then we'll look into it. And there'll be a process of looking at the market, figuring out where we can get data, what models might be applicable, and then bringing it on board. We want it to be truly diversifying. So we were one of the first people in the trend following space to do crypto. We were one of the first to do onshore Chinese commodities at a time when others weren't doing it. And so we have a lot of interesting exposures.
I'll say, wow. Okay. I want to ask about when it comes to things like that, we use copper kind of as a gauge of economic growth, right? As we've talked about before, it's used in everything that you need to grow economies. And so it's very much seen as a bellwether for that. Are there any other lesser known of these instruments that are also a good gauge of economic growth, a good proxy for a global economic growth, as good as copper, maybe better,
It's hard to top copper.
Yeah.
Although copper has become more China-centric, because China's gobbling up so much of the commodities in the world.
Right.
So copper can be doing badly because of China, but there can be good growth somewhere else. I would say that obviously oil is a classic that's relevant. But again, we're dealing with a market that has some controls on supply via the activities of OPEC and other producers. I would say that freight markets can give you some insight. But there are always interesting idiosyncratic stories in all of these markets about, for example, in freight markets, that was very much influenced by the activities of the Houthis in disrupting shipping in the Red Sea and across the Suez Canal. And by the way, you did notice that Iran made a point of capturing one ship that I think was Israeli owned near the Strait of Hormuz, just to sort of tell the world, kind of tread carefully around us, folks.
Yeah. How serious of a force is Iran still?
We've heard contradictory reports about the missile attack that was done in retaliation to the embassy attack. And it's hard to know what to make of the different reports. But an important question to ask is, what were they actually trying to achieve?
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty clear. Iran has indicated, and others have indicated, that they gave a number of states advance notice. People knew it was coming. And I have heard that they fired some of their slowest munitions, which can take a considerable amount of time to traverse the territory. They fired those first. And so their goal here was partly performative. This was not an attempt, at least according to the analysts I follow, to cause the most damage possible. It was an attempt to say, you need to be careful because we're capable of quite a lot. And I think the fact that several missiles did get through to certain Air Force bases, according to some reports, allowed them to make that point without necessarily triggering huge escalation. You'll notice that they very quickly announced, hey, this matter is now closed. What is regrettable is this escalatory cycle that's taking place. And I think there's a very important emphasis in the region. All the major countries in the region want to see things de-escalated and to focus on economic growth, you know?
Yeah.
And hopefully Iran and hopefully Israel fall into that bucket. But I do not have the expertise to tell you what everyone's thinking. But you can just look at the nature of the attack and try to infer what they might have been on their minds. But I think, again, warfare has changed. You can see that in Ukraine and Russia. The big lesson is that you cannot aggregate forces on the battlefield when you can have when the combination of drones and artillery make that a very, very deadly proposition. You have to keep things very dispersed and hidden. And the same thing applies in the Navy. I read a comment by Vice Admiral Malloy of the U.S. Navy in 2015 or 16. And he said, if I might paraphrase him, he said, guys, you need to either be a submarine or keep your head down, because it's going to be very, very dangerous to be a surface ship in a world of high-speed missiles, which are proliferating everywhere. And, you know, this problem came up because the U.S. wanted to, you might have heard of the Littoral Ship Program, Combat Ship Program. The U.S. was developing a new class of small combat ships that are very light, would be used in things like the Red Sea. It didn't work out terribly well, because you actually need a huge amount, for a number of reasons. But one very important factor is you need a huge amount of air defense now on any vessel. And that goes against light, nimble, you know. But I'll leave it to your naval experts to tell you more about that. But it's changed the balance of power. So yeah, Iran is a country that is formidable in certain respects.
But they don't have access to capital markets. You know, who's financing them? Like, who are even their allies? Is Russia even an ally? Is China nominally maybe?
Yes. And they're selling oil.
They are selling oil.
Okay, sanctions are tough to enforce, because you can sell oil to a third party who sells it on. This is true in Russia. I'm not an expert on the Iranian situation, but the Russian economy, let's talk about Russia. The Russian economy is doing so much better than many people had thought it would.
Yeah.
But the Russians had said, we've already immunized ourselves against sanctions to a large degree.
Yeah.
I sort of think that a lot of times the analysts that support our Western viewpoint, who say things that I would like, viewing them with a little more skepticism, because, as I say, we like to hear things that we like to hear. You know, and there were other people who said Ukraine really, from the very beginning, that this never really had a chance. Yeah. And it looks more and more like the fundamental difference in manpower and resources will make the difference over time in that conflict.
Yeah, as it tends to do always in battles, which kind of Wouldn't that kind of contradict your point? I mean, yeah, these, if you look at any war, it's ultimately won on, anybody who's played Axis and Allies knows this, that it's ultimately won on how many resources you can materialize, right? And how quickly you can get those resources out there.
Yes.
It's still about that, and still about having boots on the ground, isn't it?
It certainly seems to be the case in Russia and Ukraine.
Yeah.
You know, it's very unfortunate because, you know, life in Ukraine is not going to be the same now. It's just not. And, you know, I think it wasn't only Russian aggression. There was also a process of kind of pushing them pretty far, as you know. As William Burns wrote a long time ago, Ukraine coming into the Western orbit, Nyet means Nyet. That's what he characterized the Russian position as. And you need to be pretty careful when you start crossing other people's red lines. You know, but my sympathy is very much, I hope this war can be brought to a close and Ukraine can be rebuilt and have, you know.
Maybe as a Russian canton or something. Yeah.
Let's hope Ukraine can have freedom and autonomy. That's obviously what many Ukrainians want. Most Ukrainians, I would think.
Yeah. Okay, let's move back to the U.S. here. And we talked at the top about the fiscal problem that the U.S. has, which is not new. I mean, you can go back 40 years or longer and hear these things about the U.S., you know, running trade deficits and all these other things. But it has now got to a point, you know, maybe not quite to the breaking point yet, but how close are we? How much of a concern is this? What does this mean for U.S. equity?
Something like 5 years. The next five years. The two models to look at are, of course, the OCB, right? And the Penn-Wharton budget model. So the Congressional Budget Office, CBO, excuse me, a little senior moment there. The Congressional Budget Office model and the Penn-Wharton budget model. And both of them sort of show things exploding over about a decade. And there are several factors. It's interest rate dependent. So at current levels of interest rates, things are going to be worse sooner. The debt is growing by about $1 trillion every, it's at an enormous rate. It's at an absolutely enormous rate. And when you look at the charts, it's extremely concerning. Now, one aspect of this thing is that the CBO and Penn Wharton make assumptions, for example, about defense spending. Now, we just had a long discussion about a multipolar world, right? Are we going to be able to drift defense spending as a percentage of GDP lower over the next decade or not? I say no. I say we're probably going to have to spend more, not less, just to sort of maintain a semblance of power in a world of hypersonic missiles where Russia and China have the lead over us and there aren't a lot of great defenses.
By the way, real quick, just as a quick side, who makes hypersonic missiles? I mean, other than, like, is it Raytheon?
The U.S. does not have any or many functioning hypersonic missiles at all. So that's, but the Russians and Chinese have been working on this for years, and they have quite an impressive missile force. I think I will let a defense analyst speak to you more about the U.S. effort, but it's understood to be quite far behind, and we don't have many of them deployed to my knowledge or to public knowledge. But again, if I'm wrong about any of these facts, I certainly apologize. You know, so there are assumptions about interest rates, there are assumptions about defense spending that are probably unrealistic even in the CBO's curve. And the curve goes up in a remarkable way over the next decade. And you know, I'm certainly very concerned. By the end of this year, interest expense on the federal debt will be the largest budget item by the end of this.
Great. But yet, as a percentage of GDP, we're still not at Japan
No.
levels.
But the trick here is you have to keep the debt service down. And that requires low interest rates. The reason Japan was able to do this was because interest rates were very, very suppressed. Now, so there are several ways out of this morass, but none of them are particularly good. Okay. But here are the different ways out. One way out is through taxation. If you did a fairly meaningful wealth tax, so something like what Elizabeth Warren or one of the more left-leaning Democrats might propose, right? You could really take a chunk out of it. Now, you know that in the religion of Islam, there is zakat. You're supposed to give away 2.5% of your wealth a year. That's wealth, not income. Okay. And people have done calculations that it would sort of obliterate poverty in the world. But that being said, wealth taxes in a country where there's such huge concentrations of wealth could be meaningful. People are not going to like it. I'm not even advocating it. I'm just making the observation.
Yeah, I was gonna say it may be politically infeasible, but yeah, okay.
You could probably get away with some tax on people having more than $1 billion or something. And it would be meaningful if it's wealth, not income. Okay.
Yeah, forget
You know,
income.
but I'm not advocating it, I'm just pointing it out. Another thing you can do is financial repression. And that's where the central bank buys or requires somebody else to buy government securities and pushes down the interest rate. You know. And that may or may not be inflationary depending on the circumstances. The trick is you want to avoid an expansion of the money supply in bank lending. The way you would do it is you would try to just suck in a lot of securities, increase excess reserves at banks, and have them sit there. That's sort of what happened at the great financial crisis, after the great financial crisis. And the trick there is paying interest on those excess reserves, I think, as well as having loan demand be low. That's another factor. So you could try something where you just artificially push down interest rates and somehow try to restrain the financial system from expanding credit and money too quickly. Or you could just have inflation, but that doesn't exactly solve your problem because interest rates will recalibrate. Right? Financial repression, the way I've described it, is essentially transferring wealth from savers to everybody else, the debtors. You know. So whether you're talking about taxes or whether you're talking about financial repression, you're going to be taking money away from the people who have it and sort of dispersing it directly or indirectly. And those are basically the ways. Oh, there's one last way out of it, which is possible. I was making the same argument to my friend Cam Harvey. He had me as a little lecturer on his class in at university. And he interrupted and said, there's one alternative, and he's right. If the AI revolution and technology cause the growth rate in the US to climb to numbers like 4 or 5%, we might be able to grow our way out of it with a productivity revolution. It's not impossible. It's not impossible. So I can't dismiss that. I mean, there's a lot of optimism about AI, but what I would caution people is that it's going to replace a lot of jobs. You talk about in.
Yeah, in the short term. Yeah. A couple other things that come to mind, though. One is, couldn't you cutting spending? You mentioned how much we spend on military. I mean, talk about a political suicide to propose that, but wouldn't that be one way out if you cut
Oh,
spending
yes. I
10%?
should have put it on my list. Please excuse me, Nathaniel. I should have included extreme austerity, you know, austerity.
Austerity.
That's so politically unpopular that I sometimes forget to mention it. I would invite you to run for public office on the austerity platform and
Yeah, it won't have a very long political career. In fact, it'll be open before it started. Yeah, right. Okay, but then here's another one. How about additional sources of revenue? Like, say, what if you were to legalize cannabis in the U.S. federally and tax it 500, whatever percent, and all of a sudden you have this new revenue stream, a big one, I think. Would that help? And we'd have to do the math, obviously, but...
Yeah. Yeah, but bear in mind, if you are just collecting more money from people, at the end of the day, macroeconomically, it's going to be a tax increase, even if it. Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
oh, I see. So that would be the tax increase part. Yeah,
it would be more palatable tax increase. Now, you would say by legalizing marijuana, we could have a boost in production of this. And then you're taxing something that wasn't fully there before, right? There could be an argument along those lines. But at the end of the day, you're just sucking more in the form of taxes, even if it's a more palatable route to the industry.
Yeah, true. So that would fall into tax increases. Wow. Okay. Well, these are so okay. So, what does that mean for U.S. equities? And it doesn't sound like you're very bullish then.
Well, I actually am a fan of the AI stuff. Okay. The question is it overpriced now? I don't know. I would be inclined to go with the flow. The top U.S. tech companies are global monopolies. And as my friend from China indicated, everyone acknowledges that the best U.S. companies are the best companies in the world. They're just so good. And so the top U.S. tech firms are global monopolies, and it's hard to know. It's hard to even have a handle on how much money they will make as Africa develops. Like, Africa is eventually going to be a middle-income place. I may not see it in my lifetime, but it's going to happen. You know, technology, you know, is spreading and wealth is spreading all over the world, step by step. One of the main reasons we see as many migrants as we do to Europe from Africa is people now have the money to come. It takes some money. Okay, you know, to get there. And now there are enough people that they can afford to move and look for, you know, economic opportunity. So I think that, you know, I think the potential of the best U.S. companies is pretty awesome. But that leaves a world in which you have a kind of a multi-layered equity market. The Russell 2000 versus the rest, you know, and that may very well describe the world we're in. I don't know, but you know, in terms of what I do, all of this change and tumult and dislocation and, you know, wars and all of these things, they do tend to drive trends across all these different kinds of markets that we trade. Whether those markets are credit markets, some cases equity markets, commodity markets, fixed income, you know, it's certainly not a boring world.
No, not at all. Gives us a lot to talk about. And with that, it's a good way to close. In closing, however, Doug, if you would tell our listeners how they can find out more about you, whether you are active on the social media or websites or anything like that. And I will put that in the show notes.
Okay. Well, we're Florin Court Capital. If accredited investors want to get in touch, it'd be like info@florincourt.com. And of course, you know, I'm on LinkedIn and so forth. So people should feel free to get in touch to discuss macro ideas. I always like to hear, this is a short discussion. We could literally go on for hours and discuss all the investment implications of this changing, unstable world.
Yeah, we've barely scratched the surface, but that gives us something to talk about for your next visit. And hopefully you will be kind enough to join us at a future date.
It was a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Doug. And with that, we will close. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back here again in a couple of weeks. Speak then. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.